mechanical way, reacting to external demands or instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Hello and welcome to the 79th episode of Diet Soap. The guest this week is Professor Adrian Johnston, who is the author of the book Zizek's Ontology, A Transcendental Materialist Theory of Subjectivity. And you'll hear us discussing not only Zizek's ontology, but the ontological and epistemological ideas in the works of John Locke, the one who, while living on an island, never had to face off with a smoke monster, Immanuel Kant, Bishop George Berkeley, and that big German guy Hegel. This is a dense episode, but one well worth listening to, I think. It's Thursday, October 14th, and I'm Douglas Lane. If you have questions about this episode, or just want to write to me about the podcast, you can send email to douglane@dietsoap.org, or find me on Facebook or Twitter. I'm doing a lot of writing these days, spending way too much time sitting in front of my computer, so if you send me an email or ping me on Facebook, you're sure to get a response, if a somewhat unhinged one. Right now, you're listening to the theme from the film The Exorcist, and perhaps after this episode and the next one, my conversation with Mr. Johnston was dense enough to spread across two episodes, I'll find that I have exorcised Zizek. But for now, we'll just plunge ahead into Zizek's ontology. Adrian Johnston is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the University of New Mexico at Albuquerque and an Assistant Teaching Analyst at the Emory Psychoanalytic Institute in Atlanta. He is the author of Time Driven, Metapsychology and the Splitting of the Drive, along with Zizek's Ontology, A Transcendental Materialist Theory of Subjectivity. So, Professor Johnston, or Adrian, it's a pleasure to talk to you today, and thank you for being on the Diet Soap podcast.
And thank you for having me.
So just to start with, I'm curious to know about your work at the Psychoanalytic Institute. Are you working with psychoanalysts in training, or what are you doing there?
Yes, actually, to 2006, I was at Emory University teaching philosophy and undergoing psychoanalytic training myself. Since graduating from the Emory Psychoanalytic Institute, I've retained my tie with the community of analysts there, and once in a while I will return to Atlanta and do a presentation or a mini-seminar. So that's my relationship with the community there, and those people at the Institute are clinical analysts. However, Emory also has a psychoanalytic studies program based in the College of Arts and Sciences, which brings together academics, both faculty and especially graduate students, who are situated in different departments and have active interest in psychoanalysis. And so this gives Emory a very unique role in terms of being a place that brings together the clinical and the academic sides of psychoanalysis.
Okay, so just to clarify, maybe you were approaching psychoanalysis from the point of view of philosophy, using it as a critical tool when you were studying there, or?
I developed an interest in it starting in my undergraduate studies, and both my BA and PhD are in philosophy. And my first book, Time Driven, was my doctoral dissertation at Stony Brook for my degree in philosophy. But I realized after completing it that, of course, there was a lot that could be gleaned from reading texts by analysts talking about clinical experience and what is involved with the process. But I realized soon, you know, after finishing my doctoral work, that if I wanted to do more with analytic theory, it really was incumbent on me to find a way to pursue clinical clinical training and to get exposure to that side of things. And when the opportunity through this fellowship arose at Emory, they created this special fellowship to allow younger academics to have the time and money to be able to do the training, which is very involved and expensive, and often people have to put off until they're much further along and much more firmly established in their careers. I jumped at that opportunity.
Well, why don't we start talking about your book, Zizek's Ontology, here. And I imagine that your work with psychoanalysis and your training there definitely was applied to the writing of this book and may have something to do with your interest in Zizek.
Yes.
But just to start with, let's go over briefly what ontology is. It's the theory of reality or the theory of being, right?
Yes, the theory of being is distinct from one of the other main branches of theoretical philosophy, epistemology, which we could describe as the theory of how we know what we know about what is. So an ontology would posit certain things regarding what exists, and then an epistemology would spell out how we can know what we know about those things which we posit as being in play ontologically.
Right. And when I took philosophy in college so many years ago, what I found was that epistemological questions, questions of how we know things, are just always popping up when you're working on ontology, you know, studying ontologies. And then the reverse is also true to some degree. Your ontological presuppositions will inform your answers to epistemological questions. So would you say that the problem of perception, this problem that we have, this epistemological problem of how we know that what we are perceiving is related to the outside world, is a key problem to Zizek's ontology?
Actually, I would say it isn't, precisely because of his heavy reliance upon Hegel. Throughout his body of work, from some of his earliest texts up to the present, he's repeatedly insisted that for him, Hegel, this giant of German idealist philosophy at the beginning of the 19th century, really marks for him this key transition in the history of Western philosophy. And in fact, Zizek's current work, he's at present finishing his largest book to date, which is devoted exclusively to a discussion of Hegel. Right now it weighs in at a bit over 700 pages in manuscript form. And for Hegel, one of the things that Hegel does immediately in Kant's aftermath, in his footsteps, is that Hegel attempts to show how all of these problems that you are alluding to in terms of this issue of how does the subjective mind gain some sort of knowing access to the objective world, Hegel attempted to show that subject-object dichotomy that structured epistemological debates in the early modern period and even before that, but especially in the early modern period, attempted to show that very distinction was a problematic or untenable distinction that could be, so to speak, deconstructed, and that therefore the problems it generated didn't have to be tackled directly if one could go to the root source in terms of a flawed conception giving rise to what for Hegel were really pseudo-problems.
Okay. Yeah, and saying it that way, it makes it sound like Hegel gave us access to the outside world through his philosophy, kind of showed how that happens. But reading Zizek, it doesn't seem to me to be as simple as that. Maybe it'd be worthwhile to kind of step back, and even though Hegel seems to have solved it, the idea is that Hegel solved the problem of perception, maybe we can just clarify what that problem is and what the solutions were and see how Hegel's solution is different. So Locke said, well, there are some perceptions that we have that are primary perceptions that are from the thing itself, like mass and or extension.
And which he's drawing from Galileo, ultimately.
Right. And then there's the secondary ones, which like color or taste, that are in our mind. George Berkeley came along after him and said, no, there really are no primary perceptions. Everything is in the mind. And his solution to the problem of perception was to essentially eliminate the world outside. But then in order for the world to cohere, he had to posit another outside force, which was God.
Mm-hmm.
Solutions case. And then Kant's solution was to say, well, actually, there is a way to access the real, but it's a synthetic a priori thing. And what that means is that it's how we perceive the world that gives us access to the real world. And this is where I start to get confused, because Kant's solution is a little difficult. How do you think of Kant's solution, and how does Zizek think of it, and how should we think of it?
To begin with, Kant's solution, although Kant did not want to be seen as a Berkeleyan, as recapitulating Berkeley's solution, and in fact, Kant's reference to what he calls the thing in itself, das Ding an sich, is one way in which he attempts to put some distance between himself on the one hand and Bishop Berkeley before him on the other. But Kant also, of course, is aware that although he is pleading for a version of idealism, in order for it not to seem like the sort of extreme subjective idealism that you can clearly discern in Berkeley and then in Fichte, Kant's first major German idealist successor after him, in order to avoid the appearance of feeling as in a kind of subjective, almost solipsistic bubble, Kant, of course, wants to claim that what he calls his transcendental idealism, his specific variant of idealism, is at the same time compatible with our spontaneous and, in many cases, scientific realist sensibility, so that we can continue being, as Kant would put it, empirical realists while accepting his idealist solutions, according to which the whole issue of epistemology is not the problem of how the mind conforms to objects out there in the mind-independent world, which is the way in which Kant's predecessors, both rationalists and empiricists in the early modern period, were framing it, but rather the opposite. This is what Kant calls his Copernican revolution at the start of the Critique of Pure Reason, when he announces this, that instead it's a matter of describing how objective reality conforms to the templates of our subjective cognition, so that the object revolves around the subject rather than, as before, the other way around. And so for Kant, then, it's not that there's this question about, well, what do we mean when we're talking about knowing reality or accurately perceiving the object? Because we know for Kant that the objects that we have access to epistemologically are things that are constituted on the basis of our subjective structure, that our subjectivity contains these conditions of possibility for objects that we can experience, and in experiencing them, use that as the basis for staking knowledge claims that are legitimate and can be adjudicated on the basis of experiential evidence. But then, of course, for Kant, there's this second beyond, this supersensible realm of things in themselves, this inaccessible noumenal reality. And one of the things that Hegel does after Kant is to focus on, and here Hegel is very much in step with his German idealist contemporaries, especially Fichte and Schelling. What Hegel does is to point out that Kant's notion of there being this limit, Kant's famous limit of possible experience, on one side of which we have subjectivity with its knowable objects that are shaped by subjectivity itself, and on the other hand, this mysterious, inaccessible, supersensible beyond of things in themselves, this noumenal realm, that Hegel shows how the very notion of limit that Kant relies upon, and that, again, we can trace back to that subject-object dichotomy I mentioned in response to the previous question, actually ends up being incoherent and generates tensions or contradictions within Kant's own philosophy.
Hey, it's the big master control program everybody's been talking about.
Kevin Flynn, computer genius. Taken prisoner and held captive within the digital world of the computer itself. Trapped inside an electronic arena where love and escape do not compute.
Yeah.
So, hi, Ben.
Hi.
I wanted to show you a clip from the movie Tron and talk to you about Immanuel Kant and Bishop George Berkeley.
Okay.
Now, these were two idealist philosophers, and they were wrestling with the problem of perception. Do you know what the problem of perception is?
Basically, you can't really know if what you're seeing is real.
Right. You are always dealing with perception.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're always seeing things through a filter.
Yeah, your own mind. They presuppose that there's a real world out beyond the realm of our senses. And the question is, how do we gain access to it? How do we know those things? So you're right. That is the problem of perception. In Tron, Tron is actually a good metaphor for this problem of perception, even though it may not seem like one on the surface. Because in the movie Tron, you have these programs that are dealing with, you know, their perceptions. They're playing video games. You know, they're riding around on light cycles, or they're throwing discs at each other. And they take these things to be real. But they are also, there's a religion amongst the programs that there's a real world out beyond the program of users that have created the program. These two philosophers would be two different kinds of programs in Tron. George Berkeley would be, maybe he would be on the side of the master control program.
Right. That's the bad guy.
Yeah, that's the bad guy. The master control program wants to take over all programs.
Yeah.
And basically dictate to all programs how things should run. And he is trying to eliminate the very idea that there are users, that there is a world outside of the program.
But he talks to the users, doesn't he? I remember the one scene where there's a big computer and he's talking out of the table or something.
Yeah, that would be one way in which the master control program would be different than George Berkeley. Because the master control program, to be just like George Berkeley, would have to actually believe that there were no users, that there was no world outside of the program. And the other kind of philosopher is this guy, Immanuel Kant, and he's a program that does believe in the users, but he just believes that they're completely unknowable, that you can never gain access to the realm of the user. It's limited. There's a barrier between any program and the outside world.
Okay.
But what's interesting about Tron is that a user becomes a program.
Yeah.
In the movie Tron, that problem perception is solved with technology.
Right.
The real world is manifest in a program.
Mm-hmm. The real world, something from the real world becomes part of the fake world.
Right. And so the question for philosophers is, how is that possible?
You use some kind of digitalizer ray?
Yeah, some sort of, you know, laser gun, I guess.
Yeah.
Off talking about Hegel's problematization of the Kantian figure of the limit that Kant appeals to in insisting that we can only know things on one side of the limit within the realm of subjectively enabled experience, and we can't know the absolute in itself objectivity of noumenal things in themselves beyond those limits. And one thing Hegel does, an interesting little move that can easily be grasped, is that he points out how we can't know a limit as a limit unless we've been able to go beyond it, and hence can see that there is something that demarcates a boundary between two sides. And Kant says we can't exceed the limits of possible experience. But for Hegel, then, we can't know that there's a limit there unless we have some ability to cognitively access the other side of some purported limit. It's not a limit. So in positing limits, we in a way are already transcending them. And he has similar arguments against Kant, but the gist of them is that Kant's desire to solve the problems of early modern epistemology that embroiled people like Berkeley and Locke, Kant's desire to solve it simply by reversing the relationship between subject and object in this Copernican-style revolution was not enough, that one had to actually show that there was an underlying conceptual, logical incoherence to various versions of the subject-object dichotomy. All, you know, and you can say that, I think quite safely, all of the major figures of early modern epistemology tacitly took this for granted.
Well, yeah. Let me just on Kant for a moment longer, just kind of ask you a clarifying question. How did Kant justify his Copernican revolution? What was the reason that he gave that we could turn this around and make the subject primary?
Well, in certain ways, it's, particularly when he invokes the name of Copernicus and where he compares this move to the shift from geocentrism to heliocentrism, one of his justifications for that, as well as other aspects of his critical transcendental philosophy as elaborated in his three great critiques, is that he casts his glance backwards over the history of Western philosophy, and he points out, and this is elaborated by him right at the start of the first critique, he points out how thus far philosophers, assuming that we could, for instance, have direct access to reality as it is in and of itself, all they succeeded at doing is generating a series of conflicts that promise to be interminable, that cannot be resolved. For instance, later in his first critique, in the long section of it entitled The Dialectic of Pure Reason, Kant lays out for us these antinomies, which are these contradictions where you can take various propositions about such entities as mind, cosmos, and God, and you can see how there are diametrically opposed positions that are generated based on the assumption we can talk about those things as entities that exist independently of our subjectivity, and that the opposed positions are equally strong, and hence no resolution can be achieved. And Kant thought, well, that seems to indicate that really we don't have access to these things. Instead, starting from a problematic assumption, we generate irresolvable deadlocks, these antinomies. And these impasses of contradiction are a sign that our starting point, our initial assumption, was wrong. Hence, let's try turning that assumption on its head and seeing if we can resolve problems that way.
Okay. So when Hegel came along and said, you know, in order to even see this limit, you have to have already gone to the real, or at least been able to see that it's there, how was he not just returning us to the deadlock, to the original problem?
Well, this is a very complicated question, and in fact, up through the present, a great deal of ink continues to be spilled on the Kant-Hegel relationship. And one way that Hegel is commonly read, and in my opinion misread, is that he is indeed a figure who, in the aftermath of Kant's critique, thumbs his nose at the strictures that critique imposes and wants to regress back behind Kant to this old-style pre-Kantian metaphysics that Kant showed, based on its assumptions, generated all of these problems that it could not itself solve in any decisive fashion. But I do not think that Hegel represents a regression to pre-Kantian critical metaphysics. Part of what he does is that, and this is a little bit of a quick and easy summary, but it's essential, for instance, to how I talk about the Kant-Hegel relationship in the Zizek's ontology book. One of Kant's assumptions about reality as it exists apart from us is that it's free of antinomies. It's perfectly at one with itself. It is, you know, exhaustively homogeneous and self-coherent, integrated, etc. And what Hegel wanted to show is that Kant dogmatically presupposes that the nature of being is such that it doesn't contain these antinomic structures, these fault lines of tension. And so, in a certain sense, one can see Kant's gesture not as Hegel's gesture, not as ignoring Kant, but as ontologizing things that Kant thought were reflective only of our subjective epistemological mode of operating, rather than things that were also at the same time properties of the real in and of itself. And so Hegel's ontology, in many ways, is indebted to Kant and involves taking what Kant isolated in an epistemological register, showing that that was based on a series of dogmatic ontological assumptions Kant made that he couldn't justify within the strictures of his own philosophy. And by ontologizing these, shows how Kant was on the brink of discovering things about the nature of the real that he could only see as flaws of our internal subjective cognition that denied us access to that ultimate reality.
Okay, so my problem now is figuring out what you mean when you say that he ontologized Kant's epistemological suppositions or and the antinomies.
Yes.
There. I mean, that seems like a radical move, and one that, what does it mean just in general to ontologize something?
This is a great question, and also it allows us to go back to some remarks you were making right at the start of our discussion about the relationship between epistemology and ontology. And those remarks you made, I very much agree with, the idea that really you can't do one without, to a certain extent, doing the other, that when you engage in issues that have to do with epistemology, when you engage with issues in ontology, you are likewise confronted with epistemological questions about, well, how do you know what you claim to know about what is, right? And you also indicated, and this I agree with too, that when you deal with epistemology, you can't but at the same time, when talking about what knowledge is, at least tacitly, if not explicitly, introduce certain claims into play about the nature of being, of, you know, what is known, what exists, and, you know, what gives us what is to be known. And one of the things that's interesting about you've mentioned Locke and Kant. If you read Locke, for example, you know, taking a look at his essay concerning human understanding, this 1690 text that had an influence on Kant, you know, especially as part of the empiricist tradition that led up to Hume. With Locke, that book is riddled with contradictions, and in particular, up front, at the start, Locke says, I'm only interested in epistemological questions, really. What we're talking about here is knowledge is based on the ideas the mind has, and that's all I'm going to deal with. But he inevitably gets himself bogged down in questions about the nature of reality apart from our knowledge of it, or how it's represented in our ideas. And this appears in the form of very sloppy, clumsy contradictions, where Locke essentially says things such as, we can't know anything about substance as it exists in itself apart from our ideas of it, and then a little later, now let's talk about substance in itself. So Kant comes along later, and Kant is at least at the level of theoretical as opposed to practical philosophy, and, you know, of course one has to recognize Locke's huge impact as a political thinker. But in terms of epistemology and ontology, Kant is much more skilled than Locke. He's much smoother, more systematic. But arguably what Kant's German idealist contemporaries and successors discern are similar contradictions in Kant's work, which can be read as also saying, and this is a contentious reading of Kant, but I think defensible, Kant says, like Locke, philosophy really shouldn't be in the business of talking about being in and of itself. The concerns of classical ontology have just gotten us into trouble. We've ended up bogged down with these debates that promise to be never-ending and aren't able to yield any decisive result in terms of one camp definitively achieving victory over another in these issues. So let's stop trying to do that kind of ontology, and instead let's realize that what philosophy's task is to construct a valid and defensible epistemology, which will then, you know, enable us to, you know, adequately assess what we can hope to know and what we must give up hope of knowing in our various pursuits as, you know, agents seeking understanding or the gathering of knowledge. And but at the same time, Kant, as Hegel and others, both Kant's contemporaries and immediate successors, quickly pointed out, Kant has in the background a whole set of assumptions that he doesn't argue for about the nature of being as it is apart from how we experience it, how we register it as perceiving and conceptualizing mental agents. And those, of course, would be, by Kant's own life, illegitimate presuppositions on his part, but he can't help making them. And so in a way, this dream of reducing philosophy to epistemology and just disentangling it from the difficulties that are involved in making strong ontological claims, arguably Kant doesn't even succeed at that. And that, you know, Hegel capitalizes on that impossibility, that, you know, what is arguably an impossibility that besets Kant's critical philosophy too, but it's less visible than it is where it's just glaringly manifest in Locke's earlier work.
So in a way, being sloppy like Locke is more helpful because your contradictions are easier to discern. And when you say that Hegel ontologized Kant, you're not saying that he did anything to Kant that wasn't already there. You're just, what he did was he discovered the ontological presuppositions in Kant. Is that?
Well, he discovered some of the ontological presuppositions in Kant, and then he took on board not so much Kant's ontological presuppositions, but rather when Kant, for instance, talks about how, all right, if we encounter these antinomies, these contradictions, well, Kant assumes that contradiction can only exist at the level of thought, that this is, in trying to take aim at to know the world as it exists in and of itself, if that produces contradictions, that's a sign that we've been thrown back into the confines of our own minds, burdened with these impasses in thought, but in thought alone. And what Hegel does is that he says, well, those sorts of structures that Kant sketches in the second half of his first critique, in the Dialectic of Pure Reason, these antinomies, these contradictions, oppositions, tensions, etc., Kant just assumes that those sorts of things can only exist as structures of a knowing agent, as pieces of mental life, elements of a mental scaffolding that's coming undone because it's based on the wrong assumptions or foundations. And Kant wants to say, I'm sorry, Hegel wants to say no, that in fact Kant actually in coming across these antinomies is gaining insight into the contradictory structure of reality itself. And he's blinded by this because he assumes without any ability to justify this assumption from within his own system, he assumes that reality would be free of anything like that, that the world as it exists in and of itself would not contain these kinds of antinomic fault lines of tension.
So beyond just pointing out that Kant has made an assumption that the world in the real is whole.
Yes.
What is Hegel's argument to demonstrate that the numinative, right, is the world in the real would be incomplete, that it would have its own sets of contradictions within it, that it comes that way?
Well, this is also tricky because when it comes to the question of the completeness or incompleteness of reality, to a certain extent, for Hegel, one could say it's the contradictions within reality that chain together its different elements to generate what more or less, at least on a very orthodox reading of Hegel, he depicts as a reality that is an organic whole and that in a certain way reconciles within itself all of these internal points of tension, all of these incompatibilities, which just viewed at a local level might seem to be dead ends, but actually can be seen as productive in terms of being the sites at which there are links established to other you know, other structures or other aspects of reality that ultimately articulates itself again as a integrated organic whole. I mean, this is, of course, part of what's involved in the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, Hegelian notion of sublation, Aufhebung. Now, for
so just
Hegel,
to cut in yeah. here for one little comment to the side, what
sure.
I'm reminded of is the aphorism that God works in mysterious ways.
Well, that also raises an interesting question. Hegel's relationship to Christianity, and especially the Protestantism in whose theology he was trained in his youth, that question, for instance, split his followers starting in the 1820s and 1830s, and then after his death in 1831. His followers during the end of his career and immediately after his death were split into two warring camps, the younger, less Hegelians on the one hand, the most famous member of that group being Karl Marx, and on the other hand, these right Hegelians. And one of the key questions, the big bones of contention between left and right Hegelians, was the question of, is Hegel a religious thinker or not? Is he committed to some version of Protestant Christianity in particular? And that is a huge vexed issue, because Hegel, as is his wont, he rarely puts his cards fully on the table and says, this is the position I take. He's always playing with subtleties, ambiguities, trying to avoid what he calls one-sidedness. But this makes his texts vulnerable to serving as, you might say, canvases onto which his readers can project any number of different things, including, you know, him being a Protestant, him not, etc. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So back to this... Hegel's conception of the numinative, the real world, as balanced, even in its contradictions, even in its inherent
yes.
contradictions. There's another way to view this, and, right, as it being unbalanced. And
yes.
I'll go ahead and describe that, if you would.
Well, Zizek, for instance, since, you know, with this conversation has in part been predicated on, you know, work that I've done related to Zizek's own writings on these figures, he has championed a very heterodox reading of Hegel, according to which Hegel, instead of being the thinker of this absolute notion or concept, this this spirit which is a sort of a macrocosmic puppet master that pulls the strings of all of the facets of reality that governs things in this way, where the organic whole is exhaustively determined in terms of its internal architecture by the larger dynamics of the system overall. That's, of course, a very common image of Hegel, and it's one that certainly has a lot of support in various places in his body of work. But Zizek wants to emphasize that if we brush Hegel slightly against the grain, and in particular using resources from post-Hegelian thought, including for Zizek the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, that we can see that Hegel can also be read as a thinker who emphasizes contingency, instability, the manner in which, what Hegel calls negativity disrupts any fixed or set arrangement of reality and sets it back in motion, dissolving one thing into another. That this, reading of Hegel as a kind of materialist thinker of contingency and flux is, loosely speaking, a kind of heterodox portrait of Hegel that Zizek has been very interested in putting forward.
Right. Okay. So now I'm going to ask you a question that is maybe unfair or, coming at the wrong time, but how does that move in any way solve the epistemological problem of knowing the real world?
Ah, well, here's the thing is that just to take a few steps back to some of the earlier questions, for the history of early modern philosophy in particular, that is what Hegel has in view when he casts his gaze over his shoulder and looks back at the past couple of centuries of Western philosophy leading up to him, that whole period, basically from the early 17th century with Descartes, up through Hegel himself at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, there's the epistemological problems that are front and center in that period, and one could say that perhaps epistemology is really the center of gravity for the discussions and debates of early modern Western philosophy, with empiricists in one camp and rationalists in the other, that one of the shared assumptions between those warring camps, between rationalism and empiricism, is the idea that you have mind on the one hand and world on the other, that there are knowing subjects, mental agents, and then there is this domain of objects. And the question is, how do these two things relate to each other? And in particular, how do they relate to each other such as to generate what we deem to be knowledge? So this is a fundamental assumption. Now, one of the exceptions to this rule in the early modern period is the rationalist philosopher Baruch Spinoza. And Spinoza is a very important source of inspiration for Hegel. In fact, in his period studying in the Protestant Theological Seminary in Tübingen, along with Schelling and Hölderlin, Hegel, Schelling, and Hölderlin were all together there at the time, the three of them went through a period of intense immersion in and admiration for Spinoza's philosophy. And Spinoza was what we could characterize as an immanentist. He insists that he's very much opposed to what we might call a kind of two-world metaphysic, in which you have separate strata levels or layers of reality, and then the problem of how they relate to each other. For Spinoza, then, the finite knowing mind is not separate from the world of substantial reality. It is itself an immanent fold or inflection, a kind of torsion of that reality. You could think of it in very simple non-philosophical terms as we, as minds, are small, tiny grains of sand in the universe where the universe gazes upon itself or reflects back upon itself, right? So we're entirely internal or immanent to reality. We're not separate from it as a mind that exists in some unspecified other level, register, domain that then we have to figure out how it connects to the world. The issue is that we are a part of the world, and we're a part of the world in which there's a kind of folding back of the world upon itself through reflexive self-consciousness. And this is really fundamental to Hegel's outlook. He thinks that whereas the subject-object dichotomy leaves a lot of unanswered questions about, how do you really establish that there is this neat and clean separation between mind on one hand, world on the other, subject on the one side, the objects that it does or doesn't relate to and trying to gain knowledge on the other. The issue is that, we are fully immersed in this world. We're a part of it, yet at the same time, we're a peculiar part of it. Which is what Hegel is getting at when he very famously talks about in the preface to his 1807 Phenomenology of Spirit, that we have to think substance also as subject, that we are that part of substance that has undergone this process of becoming subject, and that then part of the challenge of philosophy is to explain the genesis of subjectivity out of substance. But that's very different than thinking you have a problem of some sort of absolute line of demarcation or gap between knowing mind and known world that has to be bridged through the sorts of epistemological maneuvers that Hegel's predecessors in the early modern period were concerned with carrying out.
See, I want to go back to my own experience when I was studying this stuff, because when I was in college, I read Bishop George Berkeley, and I ended up actually being convinced for a while. It was easy in my 20s, smoking pot and stuff, to be convinced by Berkeley. And so I was convinced that the material world didn't exist, for a time. It was problematic.
Right.
And I loved Spinoza because I thought Spinoza solved Berkeley's problems.
Before Berkeley came on the scene.
Right. Right.
Yes.
So I thought, okay, Spinoza is offering me this solution for Berkeley. Berkeley has an incoherent universe because he has to have this God that would be the numinative again outside, which he's already eliminated. He's shown how you can't have that. So he can't have his God. Spinoza comes along and says, okay, no, here's how it works. We're all this necessary substance, and then we're, as you described, and I thought it was a very neat solution. There was no need for the material world in it. But then I ran into a problem with Spinoza. It seemed like Berkeley's problem returned, but in a new guise, it was a problem of necessity versus contingency.
Yes, this is also a very important issue.
So, yeah, but doesn't it seem to you to kind of parallel or be the same as the problem that Descartes might have with the subject and object in the contingent and necessary? Is sort of, it seems to me to be a reflection of the same problem.
Well, there are several things to be said here. And the first is that as far as both Schelling and Hegel, this is one thing that they shared in common in their relationship to Spinoza. Both of them complained that with Spinoza, on the one hand, you have this affirmation of the immanence of mind to substance. But Spinoza leaves unexplained several things. First, there's no account of why it is that this substance that Spinoza alternates between naming God and nature, why this single, indivisible, infinite one-all splits itself into, for instance, these refractions that we experience as the incommensurability between the attributes of thinking and extension, the various modes. Why does this substance, for instance, come to appear to itself as it does in the form of the finite subjective consciousnesses of human beings, right? And that's left mysterious in Spinoza's philosophy. He posits that there, of course, you know, is this world of things that appear to be finite, some of which are thinking things, some of which are extended things with various and sundry other properties, but that beneath this, ultimately everything is this homogeneous ontological unity of this single substance. And one of the questions that's left unanswered that leaves Spinoza's subsequent German idealist readers dissatisfied is, well, what accounts for this substance splitting itself up into these multiple appearances, into this kaleidoscopic array of finite phenomena? And another problem has to do with, yes, Spinoza's determinism. That Spinoza, of course, you know, as you indicate, was a thoroughgoing determinist. That for him, as human beings, our sense of how free we are, the strength of that feeling is proportional to the degree of our ignorance of the sum total of causes that determine us to think what we think and do what we do. And of course, Schelling, Hegel, Hölderlin, these young minds were reading Spinoza at the same time in which events were unfolding on the ground in France in the wake of the French Revolution, and they were ardent supporters of the French Revolution and thought that this of course Hegel throughout his whole career emphasizes that this is this world historical turning point that is absolutely decisive for cementing in place the gains of modernity in terms of the realization, the concrete social realization of the full extent of human freedom. That these minds and Kant before them, they were very enthusiastic about the cause of freedom and the gains it seemed to be making at the end of the 18th century. And so, of course, they were interested in reading Spinoza in a way that would allow for, on the one hand, an affirmation of the immanence of all things to each other, but without ending up with the kind of stifling, subject-squelching determinism that, of course, is also a part of Spinoza's philosophy.
Mm-hmm. And I think you point out in your book, Zizek's Ontology, and I know Zizek has pointed out that if we were to know the real directly, that it would have this effect of returning us to determinism, that it would eliminate our subjective free will, or at least it would seem to.
That's Kant's fear, certainly, and that's, yes, I talk about that in connection with a very famous passage in Kant's second critique, the Critique of Practical Reason, in which he says if we gain direct access to what we truly were in and of ourselves, because for Kant, your actual being is as inaccessible to you as the actual being of other things in themselves. So you can only know yourself as you appear to yourself, and then the question is, well, what are you really behind the veil of your own appearance to self? And he speculates that if we could peer behind that curtain that stands between us and ourselves, even at the level of our internal self-consciousness, we would perhaps be confronted with the horrific spectacle of this exhaustively determined, he doesn't mention Spinoza's name, but very much a Spinozistic vision of creation or the universe. talking about this issue of Spinoza's philosophy also allows me to get at the whole question of what justifies Hegel's moves against Kant immediately after Kant. And one quick way to point out the relevance of Hegel's debt to Spinoza in terms of what's influencing how he is positioning himself with regard to Kant has to do with what Hegel thinks is one of Spinoza's great insights, which has to do with the nature of how we think the notions of the finite and the infinite that, of course, are very key to Kant's philosophy as well as to much of Western philosophy as a whole. And one of the things Spinoza realizes is that if God is infinite, as God is defined as being throughout most of Western philosophy and theology, then the idea of God as transcendent, which also tends to be how God is envisioned, especially in mainstream monotheisms, these two things are incompatible. For Spinoza, God being both infinite and transcendent, this is like trying to talk about a square circle. Because if God is transcendent, in other words, stands over and beyond in some separate domain, if what we identify as infinite is treated as just simply separate from the finite, standing apart from it, then it's not truly infinite, because the infinite has to encompass everything, including the finite. So we can't think of the infinite and the finite as neatly and cleanly separated, where the infinite is transcendent vis-a-vis the finite, that these two things are internal to each other, are mutually embedded. And for Hegel, one of the things this indicates about Kant is Kant always wants to emphasize our finitude as knowers, that we are limited, constrained, that we have these definite boundaries that we have to operate within. When we try and reach beyond them, we just land ourselves in the muddles of irresolvable contradictions and deadlocks. And what Hegel wants to point out is that, well, based on what is meant when we talk about the finite, which itself requires the infinite in its very conceptualization, when we think about these things in a way that's influenced by Spinoza's insights, we realize that we can't affirm our absolute finitude, that the finite and the infinite cannot be held apart and separate, as so many philosophers before and after Spinoza wanted to do, including Kant.
How does Spinoza account for the finite? I can understand why an infinite God can't really be, it would have to be immanent, but I can't see how you could have the finite. It's the same thing with contingency and necessity, I think.
This is a great question. In fact, this is a question that one can see as having exercised the minds and the philosophical efforts of especially Schelling and Hegel. That, for instance, Schelling, another philosopher, a contemporary of Hegel's. They were friends in their youth, but after Hegel published The Phenomenology, which contained some nasty remarks about Schelling, their relationship fell apart. Schelling, who is one of the other major figures in post-Kantian 19th century German idealism, he wrestled with this, and it led him to construct this project that he never finished. He just had successive drafts of a part of it. This project he entitled The Weltalter, The Ages of the World. And it's this, what appears to be largely metaphorical narrative of the creation of reality by God, but in a way that is quite different from standard biblical versions of that sort of creation story as one would find in Genesis. And this is an attempt to work out in a kind of mythical format this very problem of what would lead infinite substance. We don't necessarily need to think of it as God in any Judeo-Christian sense, but what would lead this infinite, indivisible substance to shatter itself into this multitude of finite entities and events, these localized phenomena or subjects? And in a way, that's what that sort of genetic account of how you have this infinite, indivisible substance split itself up into this multiplicity of divided finite beings. This is something which both Hegel and Schelling are seeking to try and explain in their own ways.
Do you find that Schelling's answer and his cosmology or his little story about the creation of the universe to be compelling?
Well, Yes and no. I'm deeply ambivalent about Schelling's efforts along these lines, and it for me, in terms of my own work that I'm presently immersed in, and that in many ways is influenced by the work that I did on Zizek's readings, his Lacanian interpretations of Kant, Schelling, and Hegel, especially. I'm interested in developing a natural scientific account of this, such that we could think of, because one should bear in mind that Spinoza alternates between referring to this substance as God or as nature. And that, of course, was part of why, along with the emphasis on God's immanence and some other very non-traditional ways of talking about this word that sits at the center of monotheism, got himself into so much difficulty, ended up suffering the Jewish equivalent of excommunication, being banned from his synagogue. His book, his magnum opus, The Ethics, was considered to be a blasphemous, heretical document that for almost two centuries after its publication, you did not want to be caught red-handed with. I'm interested in developing, rather than a kind of theosophical narrative, as Schelling especially seeks to elaborate to account for this. I think that a secular narrative that relies upon a combination of, for example, psychoanalysis and certain of the natural, especially life sciences, is able to articulate something along these lines, at least when it comes to talking about the formation of the sorts of subjects that we are.
Blue Beam Conspiracy, Part 1. The trouble with advocates of paranoid awareness, enemies of the control system, dreamers who want to expose the dream world, Matrix warriors who seek to be the one, and all the hordes of practical types who relegate their investigations to the realm of nuts and bolts, deep politics, is that none of them are quite paranoid enough to understand what's going on. A prime example of the difficulty would be how various conspiracy investigators have dealt with the blue beam theory. What is Project Blue Beam? My friend Neil Kramer summed it up in his blog, The Cleaver, this way. Quote, "In short, Project Bluebeam is a highly classified black budget project that takes the application of holographic technology to another level. An integrated array of satellite-mounted lasers and ground installations will be used to simulate large-scale religious manifestations and a hostile alien presence. Gods, messiahs, extraterrestrials, motherships, truly a show to capture the imagination." What's going on, then, is that the government, the real government, mind you, not the puppets you see on television, is planning to stage a phony UFO event in order to foist a new religion onto the public and gain complete control of the population. However, what's most interesting about this story is how it relies on the presupposition that there have been real UFO landings already. The late William Cooper, for example, was convinced that the government had made a secret pact with ETs, an agreement to allow the aliens to abduct humans in exchange for alien technology. And at the same time, he also believed that sometime after 2010, the government would stage a UFO landing on the White House lawn in order to brainwash the public that aliens were real. In fact, Cooper thought that the government would use alien technology in order to pull off the fake UFO stunt, and that the aliens themselves were giving the orders. That is, the big secret was that the fake UFO landing would, in fact, be orchestrated by real aliens. It would be a fraud that would present a truth in a lie. If one stops to consider the story, it quickly takes on its contradiction. Whatever remains convincing about the Blue Beam conspiracy theory stems only from the deadlock, the possibility that Blue Beam could be true in any conventional or empirical sense dissolves, but we are left with the contradiction at its core. And to continue, we have to adopt a sort of dream logic. What is truly strange about the Blue Beam scenario is the way in which this deadlock, the self-contradiction seems to be endemic not just to conspiracy theories, but also to philosophical systems of epistemology and ontology. For example, Bishop George Berkeley posited that the world was made entirely of perception. He demonstrated that what we take to be matter, that abstract substance without qualities that provides a substrate for perceived reality, was nothing more than a category mistake. Matter itself was logically impossible. How could something be if it had no way of being? How could something without any perceptible qualities be the source of all perceptions? What Berkeley proved was that matter, in order to be the substrate that supported reality, was impossible. Matter as substance without qualities, an essence without expression, could not be. The trouble was that, by eliminating matter, Berkeley also exposed at least a methodology for eliminating any and all other substrates. Attempts were made to correct the problem, but in every case the contradiction would reappear. Kant's synthetic a priori, being a contingent fact that was also necessary, is the first example that comes to mind, but there are others. And if one leaves philosophy behind, if one moves into religion or spirituality, for instance, the impasse is only ignored, but does not disappear. In religion, we have Christ, who is both God and man at the same time. Or we have a Zen, with its universal mind that is also no mind. When one sees this contradiction, this split between reality and what is perceived, popping up everywhere, the temptation is to attempt to reconcile the contradiction by blending the two into one. But this amounts to falling for the conspiracy. It means accepting that the aliens are among us, but that they are also really a cover story for some deeper mystery. Or, in the case of philosophy, it means abandoning questions of ontology and epistemology and caring only about utilitarian questions. In religion, it manifests as believing in God on Sundays, or accepting that neither our perceptions of the world nor our ideas about what lies behind our perceptions are worth a damn. Instead, one practices methods and techniques, breathing methods, thinking techniques, to help one remain unattached and uninvolved. With this approach, we go along to get along, adopt a tolerance toward everything, meditate, and eat lots of bran. Perhaps we can best understand Blue Beam as a symptom, and as a symptom, it is itself out of joint. What needs to be realized is the conspiracy in the conspiracy theory, the self-contradiction, the absurd and fantastical quality of the story. This is what is most true about Project Blue Beam. What we need to understand if we're going to get to the bottom of this mystery is what's right there on the surface. Well, that wraps up the 79th episode of the Diet Soap podcast. We'll pick up with Professor Adrian Johnston again next week and continue our conversation about Zizek's ontology. The conversation becomes a bit more casual in the next week, and I'll present part two of my Blue Beam essay next week as well. Okay, so this week you also heard a clip from Tron, some music from the upcoming film Tron, which is yet to be released. And you also heard from my son Benjamin, who was nice enough to step in and help me explain Berkeley and Kant. It was a pleasure to talk to Adrian Johnston, and I hope to have him back to talk about 6-8 in Paris sometime in the future. Right now you're listening to the theme from the motion picture The Thing, but in just a moment you'll be listening to Miriam with this week's Titanic Factoid.
April 14th, 1912 was a cold, clear, calm night with no moon. And when the Titanic hit that iceberg, there's no question that it had an enormous impact on the ship. The lookout saw the iceberg at 11:39 p.m., and he immediately informed the bridge, and 37 seconds later, the ship hit the iceberg. Water gushed into it, and we all know how the rest of the story goes. But what about that actual iceberg? Well, a number of people saw it. It was very dark, and it was late at night. A couple of people claimed to have seen it. Pieces of ice flew onto the bridge of the ship. But after the boat went down, some of the survivors were able to describe the iceberg that they thought that the ship hit, but no one ever knew for sure exactly which iceberg the Titanic hit. After the fact, a few days later, after the Titanic sank, various ships went into the area to try to find survivors, to recover dead bodies. There were some reports that there was only one large iceberg in the area, but other reports indicate that there were a number of icebergs in the area, and no one has ever known exactly which iceberg the Titanic hit. Based on what people said who were on the ship, it was over 60 feet high, maybe up to 100 feet high, and somewhere between 200 to 400 feet long. And there's a report that some red paint was on an iceberg, as witnessed by someone who was on a ship that came after the sinking of the Titanic. And there is actually a print of an iceberg that possibly is the one that the Titanic collided with, but no one really knows. So that is an interesting thing about that iceberg. It's one of these things that affected so many people, created such a dramatic, very real effect on the Titanic, and yet is something that no one could ever really put their finger on. And of course, being ice, who knows what happened to how long that particular iceberg lasts. I don't know how long an iceberg lasts in the ocean, but I would say that it's safe to say that after all of this time, it is no longer in existence, and that there are other icebergs perhaps floating around up there. So, anyways, the mystery of the iceberg.